graduate school at the University of Wisconsin and now at MIT. We're talking on the 18th of November, 1985, in his office at MIT. I'm Laura Smail, doing the interview for the University Archives Oral History Project. To begin with, why you decided to come to the University of Wisconsin?
Yes, I was a candidate for a master's degree at the University of Nebraska in the spring of, during the year 1943-1944, and I very much wanted to stay in research work if I could during the war, and so I wrote a number of universities where I knew that research connected with the defense effort was going on and asked them whether they had need for someone with my education, that is a master's degree of chemistry. And one of the responses I got came from Professor Jack Williams at the University of Wisconsin saying that he had a project that they would like to have me join, and that he could not tell me what it was about, but he could tell me that the laboratory had an ultracentrifuge and electrophoresis apparatus, and that interested me a great deal, so that although I had other opportunities in the spring of 1944, I accepted that job and showed up for my job the 1st of July, 1944.
Would you want to comment on Williams and his position in the chemistry department? He was rather bitter about how he was treated, about his caliber, your view of him.
Yeah, sure. When I first received this letter from Professor Williams, I really didn't know anything about him. But I was attracted by the nature of the project and by the recommendation of my department head, Cliff Hamilton at the University of Nebraska, who said he felt it was a very good opportunity for me. And the kind of research that they were doing appealed to me, so that I really didn't know very much about Professor Williams until I arrived in Madison. But I found that he was a very outstanding chemist who was a member of the National Academy of Sciences, which is quite a high honor, and that he had quite an active project with perhaps a half a dozen people involved. Yeah, maybe we should shut the window.
Oh, can you?
Yeah. Well, it'll be a little...
whenever I'm near a science building, is all...
All right, fine. So, Professor Williams had a very active project. He had some collisions with the administration at the University of Wisconsin.
The administration?
With the administration.
Or the chemistry department?
Well, I was thinking of the fact that he received this gift, really, of an ultracentrifuge from the Swedes. The ultracentrifuge had been invented by the Swedes, but the regents of the university were so concerned about safety that they decreed that it could be accepted only if it was not placed in a university building. And so they dug a tunnel into a cave underground for this ultracentrifuge. I was thinking of that kind of difficulty. Yeah. I don't know that I could enlighten you very much about his problems with his colleagues. He tended to be rather abrupt and curt with people on some occasions, but very gentle with people on other occasions. I found him poised to have the highest kinds of goals in science, and he was sometimes a pretty harsh judge of people who were not good scientists.
But as a teacher?
And as a teacher, he was a good teacher. He took his teaching duties very seriously, yeah.
Did you
encounter other members of the department very much?
Well, you see, I went as a full-time government employee, but at the same time, I was interested in getting a doctor's degree. And so I, at that time, under wartime conditions, a number of graduate courses were given in the evening. So although I was working during the daytime, I was going to school during the evening. Mm-hmm. And when the war was over, I made a very quick transition back to being a graduate student and got my doctor's degree in 1947. So in 3 years, I went from master's degree to a doctor's degree and was a full-time employee of the department during most of the Jack Williams Project during all but the last year of that time, I think.
So you didn't have much time to...
No. I was very busy. And
Did you take courses with Daniels?
Well, Daniels was not there at that time.
Oh.
I took a lot of physical chemistry with Professor Paul Bender. Mm-hmm. But Professor Hirschfelder was at Los Alamos, and Professor Daniels was at the University of Chicago as director of the metallurgical mm-hmm. laboratory. So there were not so many people around, and then Professor Ferry didn't come until right near the end of my graduate career.
You were a member of the faculty.
Oh,
the
yes.
Chemistry
yeah,
department.
Well, then in 1947, when I received my degree, I'd made a tentative plan to postdoc with Dr. Michael Heidelberger in New York City at Columbia University. But the department offered me an instructorship. Mm-hmm. And I remember a very interesting conversation with Professor Matthews, who was the head of the department. I said that I was inclined not to accept the instructorship because my observation was that if people did postdoctoral work, then they could be hired as an assistant professor. And also, I did want to do postdoctoral work and before I settled down someplace. And Professor Matthews said, well, everyone in the department had to start as an instructor, and so there was no question but that I had to start as an instructor if I wanted to be in that department, but that he would see that I got a sabbatical leave within 3 years so that I could get my postdoctoral work on a slightly delayed basis, and that was sufficiently attractive that I said yes, then stayed on the faculty mm-hmm. from 1947 until 1967.
And you got your postdoc year.
Yes, and I spent the postdoc year in 1950-51 at the California Institute of Technology with Linus Pauling.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that? I hadn't planned to ask you about your research because we're trying to keep this brief.
Sure.
But if you if there's something that you would like to say, I think it would be very interesting.
Sure.
I mean, after all, you were first and foremost a chemist.
Yeah. Sure. Well, I think the thing I'm proudest about that research was that we developed methods for preparing pure gamma globulin from human blood serum, and that later became a useful medical product. And as a matter of fact, several times when I've made trips to less developed parts of the world, I've received shots of gamma globulin, as I suppose many people have, because of the extra antibodies that you get that way, and we developed the first methods for preparing that.
So that's what you're...
That's what the project was concerned mm-hmm. with. Yes, I hadn't said, but although the project was a secret, it was concerned with medical products from blood plasma, mm-hmm. so that we were interested in the various uses that could be made of blood. At the time of World War II, refrigeration was not well developed, especially under battlefield conditions, and so they were interested in preparing blood products which did not have to be refrigerated, and so we worked on that. And we worked on several other medical products from blood.
And did you yourself go on working in that area
afterwards?
I continued
to use electrophoresis. But then, by the time I took my postdoc year at the California Institute of Technology, I became interested in enzymes, and so then I spent the next 15 years working on enzymes. Yeah.
That's interesting, since one of the questions I have to discuss with you was the Enzyme Institute, and you clearly knew what was going on there.
Oh, yes, that's right. As a matter of fact, in preparation for working with Linus Pauling, I spent the summer of 1950 half in the laboratory of Ann Potter in the McArdle Cancer Research Institute and half with David Green in the Enzyme Institute learning about enzyme chemistry, because I was going to work with enzymes and I had not had direct experience. And so those two people gave me a kind of a quick introduction during the summer of 1950, so I knew those people quite well. Yeah.
David Green seems to be a very controversial character, and most of what I've heard of him has been rather negative.
Yeah.
So will you talk about your experience?
He was a very great enzyme chemist. He had done a lot to make the study of enzymes really a separate field of science and concentrate. He had established a lab of enzyme chemistry at Columbia University, and then he came to Madison to establish the Enzyme Institute, or rather half of the Enzyme Institute, because he had one floor and Henry Lardy had another floor. But I found it a good introduction for to enzyme chemistry, and always had good relations with him.
As I understand it, he was working on mitochondria.
Yes, that's right, yes. Yeah.
And he had gone off on a tangent, which Van Potter and others felt was absurd.
Yeah, yeah.
Which had to do with, was it mitochondria?
Yeah, or is it? Yeah. Yes, that is a kind of enzyme chemistry that I'm really not in a very good position to comment on. I was interested in the simpler parts of enzyme chemistry that could be expressed mathematically in quite some detail, and sort of concentrated on simple things. And eventually I went to California to study the oxidation of succinic acid and came back being interested in an enzyme called fumarase, which converts fumarate to L-malate, and that's a very simple enzymatic reaction. But we were interested in the mathematical and physical sides of that, and not with the higher levels of organization, which is what mitochondria are concerned with.
So that, I'm not very familiar. Controversy didn't.
No,
you didn't know anything about it, and you had no opinion.
Well, I know a little about
it,
but I didn't don't know enough about it to express an opinion. Yeah.
And you must have been aware that originally, I think it was just to be David Green, but Henry Lardy was brought in to counterbalance him.
Yeah. Yeah,
because he was felt, I think, to be a very difficult teacher. And
I don't think David Green liked to teach, and I'm not sure he ever did teach. He had graduate students, but he didn't give lectures, and he did not participate in the biochemistry department. That's right. Yeah.
But were his graduate students and his postdocs sure what the problems were, but I understood there was real controversy, enmity, unpleasantness in his lab.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Yeah. Well, he was a somewhat abrupt character, and I think it's fair to say that there were some fairly serious antagonisms, but they didn't really affect me very much because I was there for some fairly specific goals. And
later on, let's pursue the Enzyme Institute.
Sure.
When you were dean.
Yes.
There was a question, it was being expanded.
Yes.
And Henry Lardy was anxious to get Hans Krebs here from Cambridge.
Yes, now that was before I was dean, but before 1967, before 67. I don't remember the Krebs thing specifically. Just before I became dean, one of my coworkers, actually on the wartime project with Jack Williams,
Lou Gosting
became member of that. He and Lou Gosting and I had been involved in the blood plasma things at the same time, right? Yeah, we were coworkers, yeah.
But there was, the issue was whether there would be more space for another laboratory.
Yeah.
And there, you had appointed somebody to be the administrator of the Enzyme Institute. I've forgotten what his name is, but I have it.
Yeah, yeah.
And Henry Lardy was hoping that there would be, I guess, let's see, that space would be made instead of being turned into administrative rooms. Do you remember that?
I don't remember much about that. I
wonder if I should.
Specifically really don't remember the Krebs, although I know who he was and so forth. I don't remember that. But there were a number of discussions about what should be done.
Mm-hmm. Yes, actually, it's in 1967 it must have come up in your time, because Bach is writing to William Cleland that Krebs has definitely decided he's not interested in Madison. And here.
Now, that was just before I was dean. March, I became dean July 1. Oh, no, I was dean until then, right.
Until then, yes.
Yeah, right. Okay, fine. Yeah. Okay. No, I was not there at that time. This was a year after. No, that's right. I came to MIT in January
of 68.
Of 67.
Yes.
No, 67. January 67.
Information.
So you see, in March 67, Bob Bach was dean. Yes, and he signs this letter as dean.
Yes, no, that's right.
So you see, he was my successor. So these are things that happened immediately after I left.
But that it's the implication is that Krebs, there had been discussion with Krebs, and Krebs had decided not to come.
Sure, sure. Yeah, well, that may very well be.
Oh, here we are.
Yeah.
Here we are.
Yeah, sure. Oh, yeah, I didn't really add much to this. I just, for some reason or other, it didn't make a big impression on me, as you can see. But, and I really don't know what happened, whether another floor or two got added or not.
The impression I've gotten from looking through files is that what was your opinion of Henry Lardy?
Very good.
Hmm. But perhaps not entirely his judgment. Perhaps not entirely good at times.
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't say that at all. No, I had the highest regard for Henry. No. Yeah.
At one point, you're writing to. I guess it's the director, and that is the administrative director, and saying that the Enzyme Institute is not going to get any more money for, there'll be no more labs there, there'll be no more, stick to Green and Lardy, and I guess Beinert was there by that time.
Yeah, right, right.
Why was this policy being followed of not letting the Enzyme Institute expand, which Henry Lardy felt that it should.
Yeah. I just can't say in any detail. You know, I don't really have a lot of memory of it. But adding people and adding bricks and mortar costs a lot of money, and the question was where that money was going to come from. I don't think.
Well,
that
I think
was
his
a period when there was a lot of money floating around.
His point was that there was space, but it was being changed into administrative offices rather than into lab space.
Yeah, but I don't think that's a serious matter. Usually an administrator just takes an office and you can't begin to do very much in the way of a new research program with that kind of space, you know.
Anyway, you don't remember.
Sure.
You didn't have.
I don't have any strong.
There was no sense. Let's leave enzymology where it is and move over into other fields.
Oh, no, no, no.
What about molecular biology? I know that it started, the push for that, it started before you started being dean.
Sure.
But there.
Well, now there were a couple of efforts. Harlan Halvorsen had a program with a title, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That came out of bacteriology, really.
This.
Yeah, right,
yes.
Yeah. But that's right. But then there was another fellow whose name I can't remember, and
Fries.
I should. But
Fries.
No, in the genetics department, Japanese.
Oh, Nomura.
Nomura. Nomura also had a program that was going ahead very actively and growing. So there was a whole lot of ferment, as we would say, at that time in these molecular biological areas that were sort of growing in parallel.
And the decision had already been made, I gather, to have a separate molecular biology lab. In fact, at one point, your correspondence about the Enzyme Institute says they ought to have the same kind of structure that the molecular biology lab has. But all right. So you didn't altogether approve of the Enzyme Institute.
No, I wouldn't say that. Some of these things you say are sort of surprising to me. No.
Anyway, what were the problems in connection with molecular biology that you had with it as it was beginning?
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Well, I think that the kinds of questions that any administrator would have to face in situations like that was, what are the relations of these programs to the biochemistry department that also has an interest in this? We also had a lot of biochemists in the McArdle laboratory with Van Potter and Charlie Heidelberger, and the question was then also where the money was going to come from for these new programs. Now, to the extent that some of these things were self-supporting, that is, where the individuals received grants and supported their programs that way, then that could go ahead provided there was space. In the case that they needed the state of Wisconsin funds, then there were long lines of other kinds of programs in various departments that were standing in line for that.
Mm-hmm. So how did you solve that? Because it did get going.
I think that, as you say, a number of these activities did start. I think they mostly started with federal money, though, because that's where the big bucks were, as we say, that
they got rapidly, money for the building.
At that time, the NIH programs were expanding rapidly, and these were recognized as hot areas, and Wisconsin was already strong in these areas, so it was very natural for them to expand. Yeah.
Do you remember anything about recruiting people for molecular biology?
I can remember when Helmut Beiner came in. That was perhaps a little before I was dean, but I was very active in recruiting Gobind Khurana.
You were?
Yeah.
Why don't you go into that, because that's of interest.
Yes, well, he was a professor in Vancouver, and I visited him in his laboratories, and we recognized that he was doing really Nobel Prize kind of research, and so we brought him, but he was not very interested in teaching either, so that he was brought into the Enzyme Institute with practically no teaching responsibilities, and as a matter of fact did not even have graduate students, I believe, or not more than one or two all the time he was in Wisconsin, because he was operating at a very high level of sophistication in this new field of molecular biology with postdocs. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these programs were heavily postdoctoral rather than graduate student fields. Yeah.
Did you actually talk to Khurana? Conditions you'd set up. As far as the lab of molecular biology was concerned, I gathered that you did have trouble, mm-hmm. but you as dean were involved in it.
Sure.
Getting people that you wanted. I just wonder if you remember.
Yeah.
And that labs were standing empty. Do you remember that?
Well, not so much in the Enzyme Institute.
No, this is the lab of molecular biology.
The laboratory of molecular biology, yeah. Yeah. I don't remember that very clearly, no.
But I think
there usually is some problems when a new laboratory is built. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember any serious problems that way in recruiting people. I think Wisconsin was a good place to recruit people too, because there are already so many strong people there, and people in a field like to have others to talk with. So it was fairly easy to recruit actually in all these fields in Madison.
Mm.
I don't know what year Harlan Halverson left Wisconsin. Do you happen to remember that?
It was fairly soon.
I rather think it was 67 or 68. Yeah, about the time I left, yes. And now I see him here at Brandeis University,
which is
where he came, yes.
Oh,
yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. You could go talk to him.
I've been interviewing him, yes.
Uh-huh.
And Karana's still
And Karana's there, a professor. His office is right over there in that building.
Really?
Yeah.
Is he still
Yes,
working?
He's a professor both of chemistry and biology here. Yeah.
And still producing at the same
Oh, he's doing very good work, yes.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Mura is the laboratory over
in
on
Stoughton,
the other side of the lakes, that's right, which proposed actually to build a very large accelerator.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that that project was coming along very well. They had the advantage that they had a good piece of land.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to build a big accelerator, you have to have enough land, and you also have to have the kind of rock underlying it so that the thing won't sink and will remain stable. And furthermore, they had some very good people connected with that project, and I think they came very close, actually, to get what that later became the Fermi Laboratory at the University of Chicago. And I really think that went to the University of Chicago because Fermi had operated the first chain reacting nuclear pile in the squash courts at the University of Chicago during the war, and that had been a very important wartime development. I think the feeling was, you know, if that came out of Chicago, then we really ought to put this new accelerator in Chicago and name it for Fermi.
Uh-huh.
So I think that really got decided for those reasons rather than other reasons. So I think that Mura came very close. Now they've went into synchrotron light sources, in a sense, have been quite successful with a number of other projects, although I haven't followed it in any detail. With respect to international programs, the Ford Foundation came to us while I was dean and said that they would appreciate our help with the Agrarian University in Lima, Peru. So I served as representative of the university on that project for a number of years as dean, and we sent some faculty. I remember Carl Bauman from biochemistry went to Peru on a loan so that we could help them develop their sciences and their agricultural sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that very interesting because I hadn't known much about Peru, and goodness knows they needed the help. But there were a few good people down there. And so I made a number of trips to Peru.
There were programs in Indonesia, and I think Bri Curl had most.
Curl was involved with them. Yes,
those.
I was just involved with the one in
Peru.
Oh,
I see.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Ford Fellowship program, I couldn't really add very much to. Computing was an interesting stage when I was dean because the university had a number of people who, in the math department, that you could go to for advice, and as both a graduate student as a young faculty member, I had gone over to that computing service. But all they had was hand calculators, Marchant-type calculators. And as computers developed, it became obvious we needed a big computer center. And so there was a big argument at that time as to whether it should be digital computing or analog computing. Just about the time that I left, we made a decision about ordering a computer, and so the first computing, well, we had a small computer, and I guess I hired Merv Muller.
Oh, did you?
And he was the director, and we expanded our hardware about the time I left. So that was all very much a growing activity, was a new activity, and a new building was required because we hadn't had that kind of needs for space before.
What was your, do you remember the hiring of Merv Muller?
Yes,
where you found
him?
And
yes, we found him at IBM.
interestingly, and it was sort of surprising in a way that he would be willing to leave IBM to come to work for a university, but I think he wanted to teach. And so he also became a member of the statistics department. And George Box came in someplace in that mm-hmm. period too, and that department was established and then grew quite rapidly. It was one of the things that grew rapidly during that period.
And you said there was a debate between digital.
Well, there was a debate between digital people and analog people, which was finally resolved in favor of digital things, which is of course what the current computers are. But at that time, it wasn't clear whether digital computers were going to be the main thing or whether analog computers might be used. Analog computers have their use, but they do not have very much promise for numerical calculation, which is mostly what we were interested in at that time, what's called number crunching, handling mm-hmm. a lot of numbers.
So, yeah. And you were active in this decision, were you?
Yes.
Do you remember?
That's right. That's right, yes.
Who else was, do you remember, in on it, participating in the decision?
I'm trying to think of Robin Fleming's...
Atwell?
No, Atwell was certainly involved. I'm thinking of a woman's name, Barbara.
Oh, Barbara Newell.
Barbara mm-hmm. Newell was very much involved. She sort of represented the chancellor's office.
I see.
Yeah. But the heads of, well, I think it was really a committee in the graduate school that represented a number of departments that had a stake in this, you know, physics mm-hmm. and chemistry and mathematics, engineering departments all had a stake in how this came out. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you feel under pressure about making the decision? Feel that you had to catch up or?
Oh, it was something we obviously had to do, and there were a number of projects that were demanding more computing services, and people would come to you and say, yes, but such and such university, why they have a computer and this kind of work can be done, and we can't do it. We have to go visit our friends, some other university, and so we knew we had to do more. It was an expensive thing to get into, you know, the smallest computers cost several million dollars, and so
Mert
it was a
Mueller
big thing.
In the end was yeah. not entirely popular. Some people.
Yeah, may not. He also left, I guess, relatively shortly after I did and has been at the World Bank most of his career. But recently he's written me a letter saying that he's moved to an academic institution. I forgot mm-hmm. not just where it is, mm-hmm. but so he's left the World Bank. The NASA development was extremely interesting because the Werner Sumi had been instrumental in developing weather satellites. Really, he was credited with the invention of the first weather satellite, and it was obvious that you could do a lot more from space than see the weather, but even that, of course, was such an important thing that we rather rapidly got enough money from NASA to build a new building. That building, was completed after I left, was a very active place, and I think NASA was very happy with the University of Wisconsin.
Yes, I don't know if you have kept up
yeah,
with recent
I
developments,
really,
but
no, I haven't.
Werner Sumi recently signed a statement that he would be willing to work with the Star Wars.
Oh, did he really?
That's
yeah.
rather a controversy uh-huh. around
oh,
campus.
Yeah, right, I see. Very interesting. No, I had not kept up with that. Very
what
well.
About
yeah.
Reed Bryson? Did your paths cross?
Oh yeah, Reed was an associate dean with me, and
oh,
I relied on Reed a lot because he knew a lot more about a number of university matters of a general nature than I did, and he really represented the social sciences.
Reed.
I'm talking about. Excuse me. Right, that I'm talking about Bright Girl.
Yeah, no,
Reed Bryson.
The Institute
Reed
of
Bryson was
Resistance.
In meteorology, and for a minute
yeah.
I forgot that. Right, yeah. Well, he had some rather controversial ideas, and I can't remember exactly what his attitudes were on this NASA stuff. But the development with NASA, that was really Werner Sumi.
I see.
Yeah.
Yes. All right.
Yeah.
I should.
Yeah. Right.
I think he's just. I think, about to retire, and I should...
Yeah, I would think he is, yeah. Right. Sure. The water resources management...
That may not be anything, I'm not really sure.
Yeah, right. I think of Jerry Rolick.
Yeah.
And I think he was primarily involved there, and I don't have much to comment on that. Same with the Sea Grant program.
He was a good man, wasn't he, Jerry?
Yes, and he went to Texas.
Yeah.
He was also an associate dean of mine, and he ran the university industry program,
yes,
which was an attempt to get industry in the state more familiar with what was going on in the university and perhaps develop some joint activities.
I was under the impression that he was under consideration for to be head of the Institute for Environmental Studies, and I'm not sure that that was, it was in the works when you were dean.
Yeah.
Did you have anything to do with it? Because Reed Bryson, of course, was eventually made
the director.
Yes,
yeah. I think that was probably just a little after my time.
Okay.
Yeah, right, yeah. No.
Very
on
bad.
Sea Grant, I really can't
okay,
add much
yes,
to that.
Right.
The Primate Research Center, of course, Harry Harlow was a fairly controversial kind of guy. But some very interesting things were going on there. And
when you say controversial...
Well, controversial, he was difficult. And
was he
I think
had
I think his work was relatively well accepted, but
he had a drinking problem.
Yeah, he did.
Did he already have it then?
Yes, right, yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. But still, that scientific work was receiving a lot of attention, and
uh-huh.
so that was an interesting activity. Oh, I mentioned the University Industry Research Program. Jerry Rolick started that. Wharf. Of course, the dean has some contact with the Wharf trustees in connection
yes.
with the money that comes to the university, and so I had many.
Did you go to their board
parties.
Meetings?
Yeah, well, yeah, not exactly their board meetings, but I certainly saw them generally when they had board meetings.
Mm-hmm.
They'd invite me out, and we'd talk about things that were going on in the university. I was always interested. They were quite specific in their interests about what was going on around the campus. They wanted to know names and people and was specifically what they were doing. It wasn't just a matter of talking about generalities.
Hmm.
They wanted to talk specifics.
This was a period
yeah.
when there was a push to get money for the social sciences.
Yes,
and,
that's right.
And they
yeah.
were not in favor of that.
I think they were not very much in favor of that, but I think it was a period in which the support of the social sciences was increased.
Did you have much of a hand in this?
Well, yes. I think
about?
We really defended this, especially the quantitative social sciences. I don't remember exactly how we defined that, but anyway, we certainly made the point with them that research going on in these fields was just as defensible from the standpoint of its lasting value and importance as things going on in chemistry and biochemistry, and they ought to be willing to support it. There were also controversies about the, I guess you have it on the list here,
yeah.
expansion of the University of Wisconsin in the direction of Milwaukee. So I made many trips to Milwaukee because they had an emerging graduate school which was under my jurisdiction, and so I had to go over there and had an associate dean over there, and that was contested a bit by people who felt that there should only be one graduate school that ought to be in Madison, but I must say I was sympathetic with the people in Milwaukee because it makes a big difference whether that you have a university in your community or 15 miles or 80 miles away, and that's especially true of the industry, that if their students can take courses at night and if they can send their students to an institution where they can live at home and study, and if they can be acquainted with the university scientists and engineers and see them and feel that they can sort of call on them as consultants, then I think I felt it would help industry a lot in the state. So I was always an enthusiast both about industry cooperation and about expansion into Milwaukee, although we recognized that there were hazards in both of those kinds of activities, that they went too far, but we didn't think they would. So
hazards for Madison,
well,
you mean?
That's right, hazards for Madison and hazards for getting too much connected with industry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't do classified or secret research in a university, and so our industrial friends had to understand that although we were interested in working on socially important things, we were not interested in keeping secrets. But certain industrial work can be done on that basis, so that we were willing to do those things that could be made a part of our educational program. And that tends to be things which are problems, not for a single company, but for a whole industry. I mean, if the paper industry has a problem disposing of sulfite liquor, then in a way that becomes a social problem and not just a problem of Kimberly-Clark. So we were willing to cooperate with companies like Kimberly-Clark if they were interested in working with us on what you do about sulfite liquor, mm-hmm. because that affected so many people and was a generic kind of problem. So we were looking.
So you were.
Yeah.
Actually, you yourself were actually talking with people at Kimberly-Clark.
Well, I thought of Kimberly-Clark because the chairman of Kimberly-Clark was a wharf trustee at that time and took a great interest.
Yeah.
In what was going on at the university, and I know I went up and visited their plant a couple of times and talked to them about problems.
And did you persuade him that he had to do something about?
Oh yeah, they were well aware of the fact that they had to solve some of these problems or would have an adverse effect on their companies, their businesses. Yeah.
Were you concerned about Harrington's giving wharf money to Milwaukee and Green Bay and Parkside?
Well, I wasn't much involved with Parkside. That may have come along later. But I really felt that it was a kind of a tragic, and this is that's an overstatement, but a kind of an unfortunate accident that the land grant money had been given to small towns. And you see, the reason that that had happened, the reason the University of Illinois was in Urbana, and the University of Iowa was in Ames, and the University of Wisconsin in Madison, was that these states were given very valuable tracts of land as gifts of the government to profit education. But the states, or the government, the federal government, somehow decided to put these away from the urban centers where the land was valuable. That's probably the reason they did not put the University of Wisconsin near Milwaukee. And I felt that was kind of unfortunate because it had some advantages to put, after all, Madison is a nice town and my family and I love the fact that it was removed from the city as far as it was. On the other hand, it was bad for the city and it was bad for the industry because the city needed the university. Milwaukee needed a strong university. The industry of Milwaukee needed a strong university in their neighborhood, and those states were hurt by that historical accident. And so I was sympathetic with Harrington that we have to do more in Milwaukee because that's where the people are, that's where the problems are, that's where a lot of the economic development is going to be. And the trouble with putting universities away from that is that they're isolated. So the faculty don't know what goes on in industry. Their focus is in a small town environment, and that's nice. And I guess that's been a tradition for colleges, but it's not a good place for universities. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting that you had that.
Yeah.
I somehow assumed that you'd be on worried about Madison's funding.
Yeah. Well, I was concerned about Madison because I felt there was a danger that here a very strong university has been developed and it may be dismembered by people who think it should be spread around the state, which I thought was a mistake. But Milwaukee was different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. TAs, I don't know that I can comment on that particularly. The Theoretical Chemistry Institute is something I'm very enthusiastic about. First of all, Joe Hirschfelder was a good friend of mine, and although he was away during most of the time I was a graduate student, I remember going to him with a theoretical question just before I wrote my thesis, and he sat down and helped me. And so from that time on, I turned to him for advice on scientific matters. And one of the main things I remember as a young faculty member at the University of Wisconsin was how critical faculty members in the department were of Joe Hirschfelder.
Yes,
they treated him as a kind of an outsider, and they told him pretty much that what he was doing was not chemistry, but I didn't agree with the old people in the department who were saying that, because I could see that theoretical chemistry would have important practical uses. And of course, that is what developed over the next 20, 30 years. Joe Hirschfelder's stature grew, his center became very strong, it attracted a lot of strong people, and has been very successful and a major contributor to the department, maybe one of the most famous things about the chemistry department now. So that that was certainly a good activity, but Joe Hirschfelder had a very difficult time getting that started because he was not appreciated. Yeah.
Well, even the other day, John Perry didn't seem to be very enthusiastic about it. That's interesting to hear your view on it.
Sure.
I'm going to be interviewing Joe Hirschfelder in the spring.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think theoretical chemistry was hardly recognized as a field of chemistry in 1946 or 47 when Joe came back. He had been a faculty member at Wisconsin, then he went away to Los Alamos. When he came back, I don't know much about the early history because I wasn't there, but when he came back, he received a great deal of hostility, and the fact of the matter is, chemistry is sufficiently difficult that it's hard to calculate things rather than going into the laboratory and measuring them. But since 1945, here it's 40 years, over this 40 years, if one thing has happened in chemistry, it's that more and more things are calculated rather than going in the lab and measuring them. People calculate what's going to happen. And of course, that's a lot cheaper and better if that can increase. I mean, if there can be more of that. So, and I think it will. So I think theoretical chemistry sort of came an age, became accepted during this period, yeah. Enrollment, I don't know for sure what that means.
Increasing graduate student enrollment, and you were trying to decide whether to try and control it and how to do it. And I wondered if that was anything you remembered.
Well, I do remember struggling with some of those issues. Of course, the enrollment of graduate students, at least in the sciences, is very much dependent on federal funding. And by the time I left in 1967, there were beginning to be some indications that federal funding might be reduced, or at least it wasn't going to continue to grow, and there's some worries about that and what that would do to the research programs at the university. But the role of federal money is so important that universities don't really determine their fate by themselves. It's set in Washington. Those policies are set in Washington, or the funding decisions in Washington have a tremendous effect on the graduate enrollment. Mm-hmm. Well, in 19... '67, I was very happy when Bob Bach became dean of the graduate school because he'd been my first PhD candidate. Mm-hmm. And so, sort of...
When did you start... two questions. When did MIT approach you?
They approached me in early fall of '66.
I see. And in your deanship do you think interested them in having you come here? I mean, what were the things you did that impressed them, that made them want you here?
That's a good question, but I don't really have a very strong, clear answer for you because I'm not sure they ever said very specifically. They spent most of their time talking about MIT and how proud they were of it and why they hoped that I would join them and things like that.
But you must have some idea. So you think it was your ability as an administrator?
Yeah.
Or?
Well, I don't know. I think as a scientist, too, because, of course, I became a professor of chemistry here at the same time. And figured I would sometime be back to practicing chemistry, which I am now, so that was always very much in my mind. Yeah.
you had reorganized the graduate school.
Yeah.
I don't know how important
yeah.
that was. Was it
yeah.
a major reorganization, a change of policy, or was it just
yeah.
procedural?
I don't know that it was really major. I think it was, you see, I became dean in 63. I think it, the most important thing that was going on at that time was an exponential increase in federal funding.
Mm-hmm.
And Wisconsin, being a strong research enterprise, was in a position to profit from that. They had strong biological sciences. They had strong physical sciences. And so it was rather natural that, and they were aggressive, that is, it was rather natural that we would try to become important actors in the space program and important actors in the programs of the Department of Energy. I'm thinking of trying
yeah.
to get this big accelerator in Madison. We have people on our faculty who are leaders in developing accelerators like Ray Herb. So
mm-hmm.
we were experts. We had.
So you were encouraging
yeah,
these people.
Yeah, I was encouraging. But what I'm saying is, though, that the troops were there. In other words, there were strong people in all of these fields.
Mm.
The biological scientists were very strong in Madison, and so it was logical that there should be all the development of the Enzyme Institute and molecular biology and all these other things, that because they were active people and they attracted money. So it was a period of rapid growth.
Mm. Well, I'd be interested in how you compared what the scientific, the way the scientific community operated and was supported here in contrast to Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Quite
similar in the sense that they had science faculties of somewhat similar sizes. I think the scientific community here was a little bit stronger, and they also came out of World War II having made major contributions. You know, a lot of the radar developments were made here at MIT,
mm.
and computers were developed, and the first big computer memories were developed at MIT. And MIT was very much involved in building accelerators. And so I think one difference here at MIT was that the MIT had gone more into what are called interdepartmental laboratories, things like the Enzyme
yeah.
Institute, two only
mm-hmm.
bigger. In other words, the MIT had a laboratory for nuclear science, and a national magnet laboratory, and a research laboratory for electronics that had come out of the radar efforts. And later they were to get a cancer research center and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really quite a similar thing.
Do you think that the departmental system at the University of Wisconsin interfered with the ability to develop these interdisciplinary?
No, I think the departmental structure is necessary, and of course we have that at MIT too. It's sort of that there are two structures. There's the academic departments, but then there are the interdepartmental laboratories. I think when some activities get up to a certain size, then they should be taken out of departmental administration because they just become too big. They become bigger than the department. You
mm-hmm.
see something like the research laboratory for electronics here at MIT is larger than the two or three largest departments put together. Those are very big enterprise in terms of personnel, bigger than departments. So they can no longer really be run by departments. They have to be
yeah.
run as separate entities. And there's some danger that a university will move too far and lose sight of its teaching responsibilities and so forth. So the rule here at MIT is that people cannot be given tenure in the laboratories. They can only be given tenure in the academic departments. So, for example, we really didn't have not had here at MIT people like David Green, who I think probably never really was a member of the biochemistry department, was just a member of the Enzyme Institute, yeah, yeah.
I'm trying to find out a statement, a book on science in the universities, commented that in a university where faculty governance is strong, it's more difficult to develop good programs. I'm not quoting exactly.
I
just wonder if there were disadvantages at Wisconsin that you didn't have at MIT, and what they were.
Yeah, I don't know that I would agree with that statement, because you see, administrators can't develop programs. They have to have faculty members who are able and dedicated and are willing to undertake the extra work, because it is a lot of work to raise a lot of money. And so if those people don't exist, then these institutes just do not grow. So I'd say it isn't the administration that makes these things possible, it's the faculty.
Well, what I'm really just trying to find out is, are there advantages here at MIT that you see, or are they exactly the same, MIT and UW, or disadvantages for that?
Yeah.
Except for the stronger, obviously stronger faculty.
Sure.
But in the organization of the university.
Yeah. I suppose the major difference between MIT and the University of Wisconsin is that MIT is a private university. And they have what's called the corporation, which is their trustee board. The corporation is heavily involved in raising money for the university. And they also, of course, do affect the quality control and things like that. But I think because it's a private university, MIT sort of makes up its own rules to a greater extent than a state university can. That is, they have more freedom to decide they want to do something, then just go ahead and do it. They don't have to ask the legislature.
I can certainly see the advantage.
They don't have to ask the legislature or something like that, or persuade a lot of people. They just go ahead and do it. So I think there is more opportunity to move. On the other hand, MIT is even more dependent on federal funds than the University of Wisconsin, in the sense that they don't have the state money to fall back on either. Right. That is, they have tuition and they have an endowment, but the endowment is not nearly big enough to cover their costs, so that they're more dependent than the University of Wisconsin is on federal funding. So that makes them even more interested in what the federal government is interested in, and more dependent. And I mean that in the good sense. I mean that they're more dependent on the National Institutes of Health to be in biological science than the University of Wisconsin, where a lot of money was coming into the university to support agriculture. But MIT doesn't have that. I mean, at the MIT does have more money, though, coming from companies. But here again, we do not allow any classified or secret work to be done, or any proprietary work to be done on the campus, so that any money we receive from companies has to be available for work by graduate students and work by undergraduate students and work by faculties, and completely publishable. There cannot be any restrictions on that.
Would you have had a math research center here?
We don't have a math research center.
I mean, like,
but
you remember the Army math research center.
Well, we have the equivalent of that in a sense, but it's off campus, and that is MIT operates Lincoln Laboratory for the federal government.
I mean, you knew about the controversy connected with the math research center at Wisconsin, which became very bitter
at the end of
the 60s.
That's right. That happened really after I left.
After you left.
Sure.
And whether it was secret research or not, nobody seems to know.
Sure. Yeah.
Except you probably do.
Well, I think they did do some secret research there. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
and would not have done that here on campus?
Well,
that, what do you say, they put it off campus?
At that time, I think some secret work was being done on the MIT campus. It was really the 1969-70 period that drove any classified research off campus.
Mm.
You see, when I came to MIT, it included what's now called Draper Laboratory, which is a separate organization, where they were doing inertial guidance of missiles. As a matter of fact, MIT actually had the contract on the guidance systems that took the Apollo mission to around the moon and back. In other words, MIT didn't just contribute knowledge, they actually were prime contractors who were responsible for delivering gyroscopes that would do that job and checking them out and stuff like that. So the 69-70 period, though, the trustees of MIT decided that was too much involvement in the real world. They did not want that to happen again. So they actually split Draper Laboratory off. So that happened during that period. So we had a counterpart kind of thing to what happened with the Math Center, I suspect, although I don't really know what happened in the Math Center. But there were a lot of feeling at MIT at that time that the MIT was too much involved, not just in the space program, but also in military satellite matter. So they separated that part of MIT off and made it a separate not-for-profit company that's completely separate now.
Was some bitterness at you for taking Quran out of the way.
Well, I suppose so, and it's too bad, but we had an opportunity here, and it appealed to him, and I think he had many friends in the East, and so that's life, I guess.
All's fair.
I didn't have that. I had no grudge against the University of Wisconsin. I was spent a good part of my career there and enjoyed it, never thought I'd leave, but... No, I think our biology department was anxious to expand in areas like that and made him an offer jointly with the chemistry department, and he accepted it, yeah.
The last question I have. Is of research in the medical school and whether this concerned you and whether you ever tried to do anything about it, because many people felt it
sure.
held back the life sciences.
Sure, yeah. Well, those were all things of concern. Of course, the McArdle Laboratory was a world-renowned laboratory.
Yes, aside from the McArdle Lab.
Sure, aside from McArdle. And I think there were some other good things there. The university always has a number of things that can be done better. Deans work on those things.
when you, from this vantage point, hear about the University of Wisconsin, let's say, particularly the life sciences and chemistry, who are the people and what are the programs that are thought of as outstanding?
Oh, that's very difficult for me to answer because, first of all, let me say in the 4 years that I've been back to being a professor of chemistry, I've really avoided getting into these more global kinds of issues. I'm interested in my own field of chemistry right now and am not well informed or really up to date, but the University of Wisconsin is a very strong institution with very strong faculty members, and it's making a lot of contributions, and so it's doing very well from my vantage point. Yeah.
But there aren't any major developments there, are there? Or for instance, such as this recombinant DNA, which created such a...
Well, I think the University of Wisconsin was involved in that. I don't know if I could describe to you in the particular ways, but that is a development that came out of biochemistry, and certainly Addison had one of the strongest...
I guess Oliver Smithies and somebody else are...
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's a very strong biochemical community. Yeah, one of the very best. Yeah. Yeah. Probably second to MIT, which considers it the strongest, itself the strongest.
Yes, I think it is rated second.
Yeah.
I was thinking, I know that there are very strong departments. I meant any major developments
that...
just wondered if there were any that
well,
I didn't hear about.
I'm sure but there are, but I'm the best one to ask right now, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, I think I've stayed within the,
oh, okay.
the limits,
right,
and I really
well,
thank
enjoyed,
you for doing
I've
this beyond the call
you.
Of duty, greatly.
Sure, that's all right. I've enjoyed talking with you.